This show was made at Access Radio Taranaki with help from New Zealand On Air. To find more local content, go to our website, accessradiotaranaki.com.
It's time for real stories from those who make our region and our country their home. Time for Making Yourself at Home, thanks to the support from the Ethnic Communities Development Fund.
That when I was around 16 or 17 years old, so it was always in my heart that I wanted to come somewhere else. I feel at that time my parents felt it was way too far away to send me that young, and they completely said no to that. But yeah, I think it was always in my heart to explore different cultures.
Have you made it to Australia yet?
I haven't, actually.
I haven't been.
No. I did say, when I get my citizenship, it'll be easier just to go across. And I did get my citizenship 3 years ago, and I still haven't gone. I had other priorities to travel elsewhere. But I have to make it over to Australia. It's so close.
Australia was one of the first foreign countries I think I ever became conscious of.
Oh, did
and
you?
I became very obsessed
really?
With it. Yeah, at a very young age. I was maybe, you know, seven, I think. Six or seven years old, and I became there. The city I grew up in had like an international festival where there was each, you know, a lot of different countries had tents set up or, you know, displays and things. Mm-hmm. And there's a big, huge cultural event. It took over an entire city park, and it was there for weeks. Mm-hmm. And my parents took me there a few times, and I just wanted to spend as much time as possible in the Australian part.
Yeah.
And while I was applying for PhDs, there was a couple opportunities in Australia, and I was kind of considering applying for it, but then I never even sent the applications off, and the situation in New Zealand was there, and I just took it. And
yeah.
I've been in New Zealand for 8 years now. I still have not set foot in Australia.
Yeah.
No, that was the first country I ever really wanted to go to. Yeah. And I've been a lot of different places.
Yeah, I guess because it's close, we think like, yeah, I will leave it for like, yeah, the next trip, and then, yeah, we leave it.
Yeah, I feel like for Mexico, the lens I always picked up from this side of the world was kind of, I guess the word that comes to me is freedom. Freedom of expression, of being, of dressing, of speech. Growing up in a very traditional culture, I had always a sense of kind of not fitting quite in that space or needing a bit more of that feeling of expression. I always felt that Australia always portrayed that lens to me. When I would look at things from Australia, it just felt really appealing that it was a lot of safety in being who you are. And I always feel like that is something very present in New Zealand culture too, that people are really comfortable just being on their own selves, even if they are just, they're so connected to nature that they're just, it's so ingrained in New Zealand culture. Mm. Yeah.
So yeah, talking a little bit more on that, like how was the change from Mexican culture and arriving here, what things were like impacted you the most?
That impacted me the most.
Yeah, or where you were surprised or you were like, oh, what's this?
Is there a culture shock?
Well, there always is a little bit, for sure. I mean, I definitely miss my food. I had to cook it.
Me too.
I have to like cook it at home by myself now, the spicy food, like all that. But I feel it's just something that we all, people that are foreign, we tend to speak about, or Latin people we talk about, that like being very comfortable with no shoes, it was a big, big, big thing for me, because it's completely the opposite in Mexico, that taking your shoes off inside of the house is disrespectful. And here it's completely the opposite. If you walk into someone else's house, it's not proper. So seeing people in the supermarkets and seeing kids in winter time just coming out of school and just taking off their shoes and walking barefoot in the sidewalk, for me that was like, whoa, that is really, really hardcore. So that was awesome to learn how to remember how to be barefoot. And yeah, the seasons were also a big, big aspect that was a learning for me, because Mexico, it's predominantly, at least the place where I'm from, summer is really strong. We do have winters, but they're not as long or predominant as probably there, or not as marked that in New Zealand, and that impacts the food, how we eat our food as well, the foods that are available in winter, the foods that are only available in summer. That was very different coming to live full winters, full autumns, and full springs, and seeing what food was available, wasn't. I mean, now with exchange, we have more access to more international food, but if we really follow the seasons, that's something I never grew up with, to learn how to live with seasons. I had a lot of resistance to embrace winter, definitely, so it has been a big learning how to live a winter, not only in kind of embracing the coziness, but to learn the, like, the simplicity, the quietness, the slowing down. That was something I never grew up with. So that was huge, living in New Zealand, living through seasons, grounding into the earth, barefoot, having access to clear water. That is huge as well. Like, it's just something I never grew up with. Just, we always drink from bottled water, and to actually have spring water, that is a whole new language for my body completely. See, and my parents always, when they come, they always highlight the brightness of the colors of, look how green that looks, look how blue that looks, the ocean, the sky. That is also very, very impactful for me to see, like, fresh air. I remember coming back to Mexico when we were kind of dating, and I would come and visit my husband and then go back home and just feeling like, oh, I can't wait to go back to New Zealand to take a deep breath because it's so fresh air. So that was also quite impactful to see that. It's just very different the first few years. In terms of community and relationships, I also found that I feel like Mexicans, we don't respect kind of personal space that much. We're so many, we're in population, and everyone's kind of close to each other. And in New Zealand, because there's so much space, everyone kind of loves their personal space. So I was very used to being very close to people, so that I feel like my political family, my husband's family, they learn to get used to me saying hello, giving a kiss and a hug, which Kiwis probably are not very used to. They find a little bit invasive sometimes. Like, well, that's a bit too much. Yes, it's like, well, we're just met. But for, I guess, in Mexico or a Latin person, it's not a proper hello until you even have some contact, like a hug or a cheek kiss or something like that. Friendships has been a big, big learning for me, how to relate to other cultures different to mine in New Zealand.
What part of Mexico are you from?
I'm from the north, Monterrey. That's my city. It's like kind of 4-hour drive to Texas state, to the border. Yeah, it's quite deserty. Mm. Yeah.
Is that Baja?
No. Okay. Wow, so that's okay. California. So Texas would be on that, okay. the other coast.
Gotcha.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, kind of desert. Monterrey means Monterrey is like the king of the mountains. It's a city completely surrounded by mountains. Quite arid, quite a bit of desert. Yeah, dry heat.
How many people live there?
Oh, like 4 million people in the city. It's a big city. Yeah.
Is that where the monarch butterfly migration goes through?
That's more in the central part of Mexico.
Okay.
And they go to the south. Yeah, mm. The monarch. That's a very big thing in Mexico. Mm. Yeah, the migration of the monarchs. Yeah.
Yeah. And what traditions do you keep now that you live here? Like, do you have something like in your family or at home that you keep, like, Mexican traditions?
Yes, like, we celebrate Christmas on the 24th in the evening, in the night. So that in Indonesia, and it's the 25th in the morning.
Like, a barbecue. Same as in Spain. Yeah, we do the same in
the
Spain.
The
24th. The 24th at night.
Yes.
That's what we move, yeah.
Yeah, so I've been really conscious of how that was a tradition for us, and it felt like 24, it was nothing here, and I thought, like, I feel like not celebrating, like, that Christmas Eve. So in our family, we do make that commitment to have a special evening on the 24th. What else would be a tradition? I do try to celebrate the Day of the Dead, too, more symbolic as well, just... I've tried to integrate some, because there's really good movies now as well that they've created so the kids can also learn the meaning of the Day of the Dead. There's some good books as well that I've given to my kids. What's it called? Ghost, I think it's called Ghost. It's like a comic book, but it talks about the Day of the Dead. So I do try. I've done a few community parties. I think you might.
Clara's been to one. When we just met, I think like the first one. Yeah, and it was really nice. Yeah.
Yes, it was. A few Kiwis came to that. I was a bit shocked about the whole Latin padding, a lot of vibes. So yeah, probably celebrating the Day of the Dead is very, it was very nice tradition to keep. Yeah.
For our listeners who may not be familiar with the that celebration, would you like to
talk a bit more about
describe
it?
Describe that a bit? Yeah, sure.
Of course. So Day of the Dead is a very ancient tradition, more celebrated on the 1st of November rather than the kind of 31st of October, which is known as Halloween, Halloween night. So Day of the Dead celebrates death as a celebration. So people would go to the cemetery or at their home. Even at schools, we would place altars with like pictures of family members or friends, pets that have passed away. So it's a day to remember and celebrate their lives. Sometimes you can put an altar, like their image, their picture, a food they used to like, candy they used to like. There's a special bread, it's called Day of the Dead bread, which is quite sugary with like a scent of orange to it. And it's only baked around those days to celebrate and eat bread with the ones that have passed away. And it's quite full of color. Like those celebrations in Mexico, they're full of flowers. People visit the cemeteries or, as I say, like in schools. People sometimes also dress up as death as well as trying to take away the taboo of speaking about death and making it less kind of more celebratory and fun too. It's like kind of a fun way to do. Yeah. Have you been to any celebration of Day of the Dead?
I've not. No.
We need to make another one to invite you, Brian.
Yeah. Yeah, please do.
Yeah. Are you planning to do one this year?
I don't know. Brian's like, please.
Yes. Now we are encouraging you to do one.
I know. I'll think about it. Yeah.
Yeah, perhaps we can organize something like with making yourself at home, like for the whole migrant community.
Definitely.
Yeah, with, of course, with your help that you know what's needed and, how to make that party special.
It's always fun. Yeah. Color, celebration. I mean, it's nice to celebrate. I think, Mexicans have a bit of a reputation that we celebrate everything. So just make everything a celebration. Hanukkah, yay. Christmas,
I think that's like very common from the Latin community, I guess.
Celebrate.
And gathering and community.
Remember there was an earthquake in Mexico. Was in 2015, I think. There was a big earthquake, and they were doing fundraising in Mexico with different people that I knew that were raising funds in Mexico City and the surrounding areas. And I remember the community here from different countries, Argentina, Peru, and Colombia, and Spain, even Spain, just like checking in, just like, how do you have any friends or family, and what can we do? So I remember one of our students from the yoga studio contacted me, and she suggested, why don't you talk to the mayor and ask if they could help you have a space or something, you can do a fundraiser. And I said, oh, that's a great idea. And I did contact him, and they offered us the council room. And we did a community yoga class, so all the funds would be raised for the earthquake. And all the Latin community offered to support bringing food. So they brought cookies and they brought cakes and things that were traditional from their country so they could sell, like a baking sale. And we raised so well to send it over. So we sent all those funds over, and I thought it was such I always keep it in my heart, that support, because it felt really community oriented, just part of the New Plymouth community, and
everyone
also the Latin
been.
Everyone was so helpful. Yeah, it was really, really symbolic. And yeah, my parents came to visit, I think like a month later after the fundraiser, and my dad brought a bottle of tequila to say thank you to the mayor, to say thank you for helping. I think that the bottle never got to the mayor anyway. I think just had to drink it at home, just as a thank you gesture for helping us
that's
use
very
the space
nice
of the council.
From your dad.
Yes.
So you and your husband, you are the founders of Sanctuary Hill. Can you tell us more about that special place for our listeners, perhaps someone doesn't know have such a beautiful place here
of
in
course
Plymouth.
Yes, Sanctuary Hill is close enough to be kind of a daily retreat place for people that are local, but also we hold weekend retreats for people that come out of town and want to spend a couple of days at our space. We got some rooms available for accommodation that people can stay, and we offer a program that involves just wellness practices with sort of yoga movement, meditation, breathing practices. The food is also quite an important aspect when people come to retreat, that we take away things that could be quite highly stimulating, so they have their nervous system also more regulated. It's a very quiet area, important to take out any other stimulation. We encourage people to take their phones away as well. So that's always a good commitment when people come and make that commitment, like take away things that distract us from being present with ourselves. We might include themes of sound healing or body awareness, nervous system. Sometimes we involve as well kind of nature activities with that, like going for a walk in the mountain or going to a sauna and an ocean dip. So we involve all these activities so that people can have a good immersion. And it's incredible how much 2-3 days can really shift our state. Bring us into what is more essential and important in our lives. And for daily practices in our studio, we offer a daily schedule where we have different types of yoga classes, from the ones that are much more restful and relaxing, which are more kind of the passive, slow down movement practices. And we also have more in the morning that are more dynamic, that kind of activate the system, wake us up, would involve a bit of breath, movement. Just different people come from different ages, different walks of life. So I think there's a variety of teachers and classes that are offered that can cater for the different interests. Some people, when they have a very busy life, they need something to slow down. But So if you had an injury but you need to exercise in a way that feels safe and supported, you might need some practices that involve more movement, but they're still within a therapeutic and space or guidance. Have you done some yoga, Brian?
Yeah, I have a personal practice.
You do?
I used to go to classes fairly often. I really appreciate having the time and space to do really what I feel like I need to do,
yes,
and spending time in those places instead of feeling obligated to kind of follow the teacher and the flow. But actually, when I get back from my trip, I plan to start going to more classes and expanding my practice more.
Yeah,
it's nice having that balance. I guess I have found, like, with your thing, like knowing what is good for your body and doing your personal practice, and then at the same time it feels so relaxing when you go for a class. Like myself as a teacher, I enjoy going to classes because it's just, you just relax and follow what the teacher is guiding you to do, and you feel held.
What I've found in my practice, because I do I have 3 or 4 different flows that I do, and I just know them, and I'm able to really find a very much more meditative state where I can connect with my breath much more deeply when I don't have to think about what's coming, and I don't have to try to anticipate.
Talking. also, no?
What's that?
Without anyone talking on the in the background.
It's just I know sequence. The flow. Mm. Yeah. And it's not like I'm trying to follow something where I don't know, or I'm trying to either anticipate what's coming or, oh, I have to go to that next, which I'm not ready for, or something. It's I know my flows. I know what's coming next. I'm able to kind of turn off that what's coming thing and tap more into what's here, really deepen the connection with the breath aspect of the yoga. That's kind of what keeps me away from classes, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I know I'm developing some terrible habits, I'm sure, in my poses, which I look forward to getting some corrections on. Mm-hmm. And expanding my comfort in different, types of flows.
Yes.
Sequences.
I can completely relate to that, because that where I met my husband was the Shivananda Ashram, which is quite a traditional school, and they teach that pretty much that, I guess traditionally it was like one sequence, one set. And it has really become a great anchor, because whenever I feel like I'm feeling creative and I got a lot of energy, I can be more creative in my practice. But when those times when I am really exhausted or I just need to move but with not a lot of thinking, I know by heart that one sequence, and it helps me not skip practicing, because if I wouldn't know that by heart, it would be easier to not do it. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I don't even know what I'm going to do. But if I know by memory something, I can just put my feet on the mat, which honestly, I always say this, the hardest part of yoga, the absolutely hardest part is to put your feet on the mat. That's the one thing that is the hardest. Just put your feet on the mat and the rest will be easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, showing up. Yeah.
Just showing up.
It's shockingly difficult to do yoga. I think people that don't do yoga think of it as this just very relaxing, very passive, very kind of calm. And I feel like that's the effect after doing yoga.
Yeah.
Man, it's hard getting on the mat. It is so hard.
Yes, yeah. It's the hardest part. Yes.
Yeah.
Glad to know I'm not the only one that feels
absolutely
that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome to the club. I can resonate with that. Yeah. I feel like, almost everyone here having that practice. Mm. And what other personal practices do you have, Bhavani, that keep you healthy?
Help me healthy, yes. I mean, for me, if I would have 10 minutes to do my practice, say I have a full day and I've only got 10 minutes, for me just sitting at my altar or just sitting in my meditation cushion, it grounds me, it centers me, and it really shifts the rest of my day. I might sometimes have more time to do more movement and that, but just sitting there and anchoring in my breath, just doing some deep breathing, that could be like my daily 10-minute thing to do. I'd rather do some breathing than do some movement. If I got more time, then I would continue doing some movement. But definitely having a set place, then the more that place becomes so familiar, it's as if the mind is like, oh, okay, this is what we're doing, we're meditating. Because if I continue changing where I'm sitting, it becomes a new place of like, oh, I'm going to sit on the bench today, and then I'm going to sit in the other room today, and I keep changing that. I know, like, it's harder for my mind to
Your system anchor. Recognizes that it's time to sit and connect with yourself.
Totally.
If you do it in the same place.
In the same place. Like, it's just, as you said, that it becomes like a mantra or a loop that, like, the same sequence, the same way. It's sort of like a container, that it is so much easier of familiarity, that the body recognizes this is safe. The mind is like, okay, this is what we're doing. And then it's much easier to go back. And it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. So definitely I would do 10 minutes of some anchoring and breathing if I would have just a short period of time. Yeah, I guess my movement practice is a big aspect of my life. What other practices I would do? I mean, nature is a big part of me. I have a secret beach place that I love. I'm not going to say where it is, because then it won't be secret anymore. But it's pretty pretty isolated, and I try to go at least once a month, and it is so good because I feel like that is more outside of my home, and I can go there, and it is much more open. I feel that is a place that helps me connect to something bigger than myself. It's close, connected to the ocean, and it's quite there's not a lot of people, and I probably never see people walking by there. So that's a very sacred place for me that I try to go at least once a year. I might take some music and just dance out in the ocean, and I like it when it's a really windy day because I feel like it's really easy just to let the wind take over and just
feel all the elements.
That's a very powerful practice for me that I don't do it very often because it's a bit of a drive, but I do like to do it once a month. Yesterday I had a women's circle as well, which I try to do once a month as well, but that is more with community. I feel it's a very powerful thing to gather with women, and how needed it is to share our stories, to share our wisdom of our lives, and sitting in circle together, sharing intentions together, dreams, aspects that we're working on. It really helps mirror each other, that we're not alone, that we are sometimes navigating similar things. Women come from completely different ages, different walks of life, different countries, mm-hmm. and coming together as equals and sitting together in the shape of a circle is really, really powerful. So that's something that I'm also really passionate about, just having.
Yeah. I have been privileged to attend some of those circles. Yeah, mm-hmm. I couldn't attend the one yesterday, but yeah, I totally recommend, like, for any women wanting connection and in a safe space, mm-hmm. to try these women's circles. Yeah, the connection that sparks from that is beautiful.
I found they're really needed, these spaces, safe spaces to be unmasked, truthful. And it is simply an opportunity to share, give voice to whatever is alive in us in that moment, which is easy to swallow, to push down, and not give it a voice. And here we're witnessing each other speaking our truth, and it is really, really powerful how our voice is informing our reality.
I'm curious because I think I don't remember which guest we were talking with, that we were thinking that, like, we have women's circles, we have, like, men's circles that PDP was talking about. And yeah, I was wondering how it will be to have a mixed circle. Like, what are your thoughts about that? Or what do you think, Ryan, also about that?
Have you been to sharing circles before?
Yeah, I'm in a men's circle.
Oh, wonderful.
So yeah, we like to, we put it as a place to see and be seen, which I think really describes touches upon what you were describing there with the mirroring and giving a voice as well as seeing others experience the same similar things. Mm. Yeah, it's a very important thing. What I would think about a mixed circle, it would change the dynamics. That's for sure. I think
we don't have those spaces, no?
The vulnerability aspect of it. I think that there would be a more difficult hurdle to get over. I think with the willingness to open up to that vulnerability, which would be a healthy activity, a healthy challenge to work on, but a much higher hurdle, I think.
We went one time, our kids were quite little, but we went to a family retreat up in Coromandel. I don't know, maybe like 7 years ago or so. So it was all families and parents with their kids. It was so beautiful. And then we would take turns. The parents would go in the morning to do meditation, and we would take turns who would take care of the kids, like give them some drawing or take them out to do some activities in the forest. And so the other parents could meditate at the same time. And then the kids would join sometimes. We would all make food together. But in the evenings, because the cabins were all around, surrounded into the main lodge where we would all gather. The kids would be put to sleep, to bed, and then the parents would all gather in the evening to do sharing circles. And there were two circles because, well, I remember that in that particular setting, it was, if it was a couple, the couple was separated. So one would go to one circle and the other one would be in another circle. But it, they were both mixed circles. There were women and men in the circles. And it was really beautiful. Well, we were all parents. We were all parents. And it was definitely more challenging because there were men. It was mixed. But I found having man energy very grounding. It was really powerful to have men sharing and to see that vulnerability as well from men and women as well together. It was really beautiful. Yeah, I remember that. That was the one time that I've had that and that experience. And I cherish it a lot because it was beautiful to see that, to have that beautiful open-hearted sharing with parents all together. Yeah. It was nice. Yeah, we should try to do something.
It'd be an interesting experiment.
It will be an interesting thing.
Wonder who will come. You guys are hearing. Come and join this next project.
Yeah, I guess my only experience with mixed sharing circles were during my yoga training. But it was like a very big circle, so we were 52.
How did you feel with how much so many people in sharing?
It was huge. It was intense. I think it was intense. Mm-hmm. Like if you are like a sensitive person and in those sharing circles, sometimes you go like very deep.
Yeah.
And people share like very personal stories. And yeah, I find it difficult not to pick some of those stories. Yeah. So I had to do like a personal practice afterwards to just clean a little bit all that intense energy. But I enjoy having the diversity, I think.
You had been together for a month. You've been practicing together. I could see that as a group, you're growing into getting to meet each other. Yeah, I wonder, like, I guess with your group, Ryan, and with the one I offer as well for women, it could vary every month. The women that come, it could be different. Some people can come to one and then maybe skip one and then come back. So there's always a bit of a change. I do try to keep it small, around 10 women, more or less, so that everyone has enough time to speak and that it does feel intimate and not as big as that, especially because people might not know each other as well. I don't know, how's your circle quite big?
Our circle ranges from, it's a fortnightly meeting, and it ranges from probably 6 or 7 to 12-ish people. And
it's a
quite
good number.
Yeah, and it's quite familiar. Normally? It's a bit fluid who's coming, who's not. And we've, there has been a turnover rate that's picked up recently.
Yeah.
I'm quite new to the circle. I think I've been attending for about 6 months now.
Yeah.
Do you have a facilitator or do you facilitate between all
of
you?
It rotates between the more experienced men. Yeah, it's a really important staple foundation to have in my life. So yeah. Men, if you need emotional a place to emotionally connect with other men, they're out there.
We can share perhaps like a link to, if there's like a link or some information for listeners, both for men's circle that you attend, certainly, Ryan, and for Bunny's women's circles. They can go to Sanctuary Hill website.
I've got the link there and just says monthly gatherings. And I always put in there what is the next one and just the themes. A theme might call to you, might resonate. Last one we had was talking about dreams, how we connect to our dreams, because
that's a very interesting topic for Brian.
Yeah.
Oh, you like dreams.
I got into dream analysis about a year ago.
Oh, wow. Just your scientist brain.
What's that?
Your scientist brain analyzing.
Yeah, I'm extremely analytical. But yeah, I randomly started reading a book by Carl Jung, and I had no idea that part of his psychotherapy approach was doing dream analysis. And it took me completely off guard. And I started getting, exploring the space, and I find it very, very, very useful.
Yes.
I actually use AI prompting to help assist in the dream analysis.
Yes.
I find that a very appropriate use for AI. Yeah,
it is incredible. I feel like it's such a great tool. I am aware that some people don't remember their dreams, which is completely valid. But some people do, or depending on through seasons or different stages of their lives, they do. And it's such an amazing tool to see into our subconscious. And in women, I started recording or writing down my dreams probably like a year and a half ago, just like a little journal, and how fascinating that was relating to so much information of my life and things that were occurring, coming up, and how my dreams were giving me so much insight. And well, because women, we have our moon cycle, our periods, that changes. So it's so fascinating to follow the phases of our period and then seeing the dreams that come up as well through different times of our hormone cycles. So I feel it really deepens our connection to our bodies as women. So that was a really beautiful circle to explore, women that have not been interested before, some that are just starting, some that are curious about it or don't remember, and what is their relationship to their dreams? Because it's such an intimate, personal world of our dream states.
And linking that to our circles and cycles, that's really, because like so many things that change as for us women, as we are cyclical.
I mean, when we look at ancestry and women that we used to gather what were known as the red tents, and women would have their menstrual cycles and menstruate together, they would sit in circles for sharing wisdom, to share what they were creating, because women were so important in the crops, in the design of the communities. And women would be in the red tents dreaming together, because they would create also in their dreams messages and information that would come also from spirit world or from the subconscious that would inform their communities. So there's also so many studies that show when people sleep together, the relationship in dream time as well, how that is also very powerful to meet in dreams. So this is a very ancient tradition that women would be in those circles together, sharing wisdom, spending the night together to dream together, and then bring those insights to their communities.
Fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I had to train myself to remember my dreams when I first started off on my dream journey. So it's totally possible. I think it's
absolutely
really I think anybody, pretty much anybody, can develop that skill to be able to remember their dreams if they're interested in dream analysis. I actually haven't had a dream in a while. I need to start going to sleep with the intention to dream to see what's going on in my subconscious.
Yeah, I remember you sharing, like, even having the intention to remember it, like, before you go to sleep, is something that you recommend, Brian?
Yes, okay. Very much so.
I feel like the more we open up to these world of practices, whether it be, you know, energy practices like meditation, yoga, tai chi, reiki, that speak to energy, and we develop the connection to how powerful our energy is, it opens our curiosity to these possibilities of how much can I understand and be part of my dream state and the thoughts that I entertain through my day, and how my energy feels, what drains me, what brings me more energy. So yeah, I feel like what you said is so accurate, that we can train ourselves, and we have so much, our mind and our focus, our willpower is so strong, we override, or we don't perhaps sometimes not know how powerful our will can be to direct our attention to something. And even in our awake time, how we put our energy into something, in some things that we like and we want to achieve, where we want to put our goals into manifest, how much of strength in our willpower is to get there. We can move mountains when we're really determined to get to something. And the other opposition to that is how strong is our willpower when we resist something, and we is something that we don't want to have in our lives, so that we don't want, and how much that also creates blocks in our body and creates tension in our body. And what you're describing in the dreaming state of how much power we have. We have so much power to connect to our dreams, connect to our goals and manifestation, to the things that we block, the things that we create. We underestimate how much power we have in our energy, our attention, and mind. Mm. Huge.
Mm. Yeah, you've mentioned the subconscious a few times, and it's, I think, a lot of what you're talking about makes me think about how easy it is to get caught up in the world out there, and that we, you know, that creates so much noise that it's difficult to listen to what's going on internally. And that's why things like a meditation practice and yoga and energy practices, we're opening ourselves up, we're opening up those blockages.
Mm.
Just that creates that space for subconscious processes to deliver, you know, what we're looking for, really.
Yeah, mm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when you said before, you know, in our workspace, when we feel quite drained, when we start to really pay attention to the things that we are resisting and how much that drains our energy, because we create those blocks so much of how many times we notice in our train of thought resisting to I don't want that to happen. I don't like what that person said. I don't like that traffic light. I don't want that. And all these no, and it's like this whole firewall kind of going on the background of thoughts. And there are things that are rational that we might go and say, you know, make us move our direction where we want to go. But a lot of things are not necessary, that we can let them pass. It's as if you're driving on the highway and you see all these sort of trees passing by. And they're just passing through your attention, and they don't really make an impression. They're just passing. And all of a sudden, you see a car that it's the same car as your ex-girlfriend or something. And suddenly, you see the car, and you keep driving, and then you start thinking, oh, was it her? Was it that person with another partner? Did you find someone else? And then you keep driving, you keep thinking how all those other trees that were in your field did not make an impact, but one single thing just stuck. It was like stuck like a fly to the window, just like black there. And all our energy just boom goes there. And it just like ruminating. And it's so draining. It is so draining. And we end up at the end of the day feeling exhausted, not really sure why. It's like, oh, maybe it's my job. It's a lot has to do with our thoughts.
Yeah.
And the more we allow that to pass through us with less filtering, and our focus goes more into what is real and what is, you know what I mean? Like,
what is real?
What is real, yeah. Like, what is real and not in the imagination.
Mm.
And in the present, I think, like, yeah, if you see that car and it reminds you of your ex-friend, it's fine. But that's, like, move from that. Like, keep like staying in the present and don't keep thinking about that, like, 2 hours later.
Yeah, it's still there.
2 hours later, that's not the present. That happened 2 hours ago.
Yeah.
So I think, like, yeah, when I think about keeping with what is real, is what is present in the present moment. Yeah.
I like to think about thoughts not being real.
Mm.
Just because you think it doesn't mean it's true.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah,
but
totally.
What's real is, and then this is where meditation, mindfulness, and quiet, being able to quiet the mind and not listen to those passing clouds of thoughts.
Mm.
Just to be able to see what's here. What's really here. And that's where connecting with the breath and realizing, okay, just the body in space, what's here?
Yeah, and also the body, like, because I think, like, with the mind, sometimes we can get into these, like, patterns of thoughts, like, while in the body, like, if you just tuning to what your body is feeling, it's easier for me to stay present, like connecting to your heart, connecting to your body, like what are you feeling in your body, what part of your body are you feeling it in. It gets away from your thoughts easily.
And absolutely. Yeah,
it makes things easier.
For people maybe struggling with the bug on the windscreen. I love that analogy where you could be driving in a beautiful, beautiful place and just you're lost in thoughts, and then that thought is really just like a smack giant bug on the windscreen. Yeah, it's just like, in that part of the windscreen where you really just look out of, like it's just in your line of vision to be able to drive forward and you can't not see it.
Yeah.
What advice would you give such people who are dealing with those types of bugs on the windscreen?
Well, you can definitely use a bit of humor to that. Like, oh, there's the bag on the windscreen. And just have a bit of a perception of what is it that your mind is focusing on, and is that real? Is that really real? And when our attention focuses, and it freezes the screen, doesn't it? Like, when we can't catch an image in our mind of something that freezes our attention, freezes like ice, water that was flowing, all the information that was flowing, white fluid, and all of a sudden something pops on your head and it freezes your attention and you can't see the water anymore. So widening our awareness is a very important thing. First thing, noticing, oh, I'm catching myself freezing into that bug on the screen is really there. So naming it is a good thing. Okay, I've noticed this and it is in my attention. Widening your perception could help you go back into the bigger picture, what is around you, and helping you notice first how your body was responding to that freezing moment. I noticed myself getting upset. I noticed myself getting a bit impatient, frustrated. That gives me also much more space. So you have to kind of go bite size to step away from the screen, because you've froze yourself into the emotion of that bug on the windscreen. Widening your perception to open into the wider field, noticing your body, coming back to your breath, and always challenging that. Challenging, is that real? Is that true? Is very helpful. Am I noticing someone speaking a bit upset to me, and I'm just thinking how rude that person was? And if I widen my perception, I might notice that maybe that person was on their way to the airport and they needed to be quick to get out the door and go somewhere else. And that helps me anchor back into my own self, how I feel in relationship to that experience, and challenge if my perception was real. Is that truly what I'm seeing? Am I seeing someone that is being actually rude, or they're just in a rush, they're in a hurry, they're really tired, their kid is probably on the back asking for something else, and they just responded in a particular way? And come back to something that, was called an inner resource. That is a good practice, I think, for all of us, thinking of something that brings you to a state of rest. So for me, when I go to ask myself, what would be an inner resource to rest? I think of my cat, which is they're purring or in a particular place at home that I know that I can be with. So if I'm noticing myself freezing, tensing, aggravating my mind space, focusing on something that is blocking the flow of my thoughts, I can take a step back, take some perception, challenge that frozen image, come back to the breath, and go back to my inner resource. How can I come back to a place of rest within myself so I'm not completely focusing on that? Because if I continue focusing my attention on that frozen image, it's going to continue. It's like a hurricane. It just continues whirling and whirling and whirling. It's almost like a sand fly. Like, it bites you, and the more you scratch it, the more it'll itch you. Mm. Totally. You need to stop scratching it, isn't it? Yeah. That's my husband always say, just stop scratching it, it'll go away. Just stop scratching it.
Yeah, but sometimes it's easy to say than to do it.
To do, yeah. Well, just think of the sand fly. Yeah. Totally. But keep practicing that. Just let it be. It's just it's just an image. How come all the other information passed like a passing water, like flow, and just something there has just become frozen? It's just your focus. Mm. It's just your focus where it is. Take a step back.
Yeah, nice tip. So we are coming to the end of our program.
That was a fast hour.
Yeah, it went super fast. And normally we ask, we end with the same question to our guests. And it's about, for someone that comes new to New Zealand or to Taranaki, what would you recommend them to help them to make themselves at home? What are your tips?
What are my tips? Well, when you come to New Zealand, really, really connect with nature. This is your opportunity to be open and be nature within yourself. Look at the ocean, look at the sky, look at the trees, touch the earth. And that home feeling will instantly come back to you, remembering you're part of this beautiful landscape. It's not just something outside, so far away. We're just coming back and remembering that we've always been part of that, always. As you walk around a city or a town, always smile, saying hello to people. People are really friendly. Mm-hmm. People in New Zealand are always happy to help, feel open to ask for directions, chat with people around you. And you'll feel instantly kind of part of the Kiwi community. Mm. Get some pictures with some sheep, that's for sure. That will help you feel like in New Zealand. Go and find some sheep. You feel like connected to the fauna and the beings in New Zealand.
Nice. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here with us. Babani, it was lovely to having you here and learning more about you.
And thank you.
I'm sure our listeners also enjoyed that. Thank you, Brian, for co-hosting. We are missing Alina today, but I think she's back next week with us.
Hopefully she's enjoying some snow at Ruapehu.
Yeah, Alina, we are saying hi if you are listening. And looking forward to having being the three of us next week.
Not me.
I know, Brian is going to go on interesting trips.
Back on the road for a bit, yep.
Yeah, yay. Both work and visiting family.
Yep. Pleasure in, or work and play.
Okay, so you will be back in August, sometime in August.
Sometime in August.
Okay. Great trip.
Thank you.
Yay. Yeah, so thank you, everyone. Have a beautiful day and see you next week.
Enjoy making yourself at home in Taranaki.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information and others just like this, head along to our website, accessradiotaranaki.com.
This show was made at Access Radio Taranaki with help from New Zealand On Air. To find more local content, go to our website, accessradiotaranaki.com.